A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
A Prime Minister's Diary, a three-hour gap, and a nation's fury. Daniel's written in with something that's been consuming Israeli media, and he's taking what he admits is the minority position. The basic facts, on the morning of October 7th, 2023, when Hamas attacked, Netanyahu reportedly took 3 hours to hold his first formal consultations with his military chief, and 2 hours to leave his home in Caesarea. Yesterday, his office released a version of his diary covering that morning, and it doesn't match a previously released version. Daniel's not particularly exercised about the delay itself. He figures the Prime Minister may have been working the phones from home, and the coverage does note that assembling a Prime Ministerial convoy and getting from Caesarea to Tel Aviv takes real time. What you find surprising is that there's any disparity in the official record at all. He'd assumed everything a Prime Minister does is logged meticulously, and the Shin Bet protective detail does keep minute records, some of which haven't been made public. But then he pulls back and asks the broader question, are we holding public officials to an almost insane standard of probity? When facts are emerging, the picture is cloudy, and a human being has been roused from sleep and needs time to start performing complex tasks. He brings up Bush on September 11th, the classroom footage, the criticism, and says when you look at the whole day, it's hard to find fault. So the question he's really asking is whether precise timekeeping in official records has enabled us to argue over whether a leader took 20 or 30 minutes to leave the house, and whether that's a fair way to judge anyone.
There's a lot in there, and I want to start with the part Daniel says is the real revelation, because I think he's right to fixate on it. The delay itself is almost the least interesting thing. A diary discrepancy is interesting because it tells you somebody made a choice.
Right. The question isn't just what happened, it's who revised the record and what they wanted the revised version to say.
And the reporting on this is actually fairly specific about what changed. The first version of the diary, the one released earlier, suggested Netanyahu was updated on the attack at an earlier hour. The second version, the one from yesterday, pushes his first awareness later. So the edit doesn't make him look more on top of things, it makes the gap between the attack starting and him knowing about it look longer.
Which is a strange direction for an edit to go if the goal is image management. Usually you'd want to shrink the gap, not widen it.
Unless the goal is to make a later action look reasonable. If he learned at 7, then taking until 10 to hold formal consultations is a 3-hour gap. If he learned at 6:30, the gap is longer and the questions get sharper. But there's another reading. The edit might be an attempt to reconcile the diary with other records, phone logs, security logs, the movements of the military secretary. If the first version said he was briefed at 7, and the Shin Bet logs show he was actually asleep until 7:30, the second version could be an effort to make the diary match the logs before the logs get released. That's not necessarily sinister. It's what you do when you realize your own record is wrong and you want to fix it before it becomes a discrepancy.
But the problem is, the fix itself became the discrepancy. The first version was already out there. So now you have two official versions, and the public gets to watch the record change in real time. That's the thing Daniel's reacting to. Not the delay, but the fact that the delay is being papered over, or repapered, in public.
And let's be concrete about what we're actually talking about when we say the Prime Minister's diary. This isn't a personal calendar that Netanyahu keeps in his jacket. It's a composite document maintained by his office, drawing on input from the military secretary, the Shin Bet detail, aides, drivers, the people who manage his movements. It's an official record that gets compiled after the fact, and it's subject to revision because it's a human document. Somebody types it up, somebody checks it against other logs, somebody decides what counts as a consultation versus a phone call versus being briefed. Those distinctions aren't neutral.
What's the difference between a phone call with the military chief and a formal consultation? Is it the agenda? The number of people on the line, whether a note taker is present.
In practice, it's often whether the meeting was scheduled in advance and whether it produced a written record. A prime minister can be on the phone with his defense minister for 40 minutes, but if it wasn't scheduled and nobody took minutes, it doesn't enter the diary as a consultation. It enters as a call, or it doesn't enter at all. So when we say Netanyahu took 3 hours to hold his first consultation with the military chief, we're not saying he was out of contact for 3 hours. We're saying the first formal, documented, scheduled consultation happened 3 hours in. The reporting is clear that he was on the phone with security chiefs from his home in Caesarea before he left for the Curia. He wasn't idle. The question is what he was doing and what decisions he was making, and the diary is supposed to be the answer, and it's not answering.
So, Daniel's instinct that the 2-hour delay to leave the house is less damning than it sounds is probably correct. A prime minister's convoy doesn't just pull out of the driveway. The Shin Bet has to secure the route. There are multiple vehicles. There's a helicopter decision depending on the security picture. On October 7th, with rockets falling and infiltration reports coming from multiple communities, the security picture was as bad as it gets. You don't move the prime minister into a worse position than the one he's in. If his home in Caesarea is secure and the roads are not, you keep him there until the roads are clearer, or you put him in the air.
And there's a real operational logic to that. The prime minister's physical location matters less than his communications. If he's on a secure line with the military secretary and the defense minister, he's in the command loop even if he's physically in his living room. The move to the Curia in Tel Aviv is about optics and about access to the full command structure, but it's not where the decisions get made in the first hour. The decisions get made on the phone.
So the delay in leaving the house is mostly a logistics story. The delay in formal consultation is a record-keeping story. And the diary discrepancy is a third story entirely, which is about whether the record can be trusted.
Let me put some numbers on the timeline, because the fog around this is part of the problem. The first reports of the Hamas attack started coming in around 6:30 in the morning. Rockets were fired at 6:30. The ground infiltration began shortly after. Netanyahu's first formal consultation with the military chief, according to the reporting, was around 9:30. That's the 3-hour figure. He left his home around 8:30. So the sequence is, attack at 6:30, he's presumably woken and briefed at some point in the next hour, he leaves the house at 8:30, formal consultation at 9:30. Somewhere in there, he's on the phone with people. The diary is supposed to tell us who he spoke to and when, and the two versions don't agree.
And the Shin Bet logs, which would settle it, haven't been released. Daniel mentions this. The protective detail keeps the most minute records, and those records exist. The question is why they haven't been made public, and the answer is almost certainly that they're classified for operational reasons. You don't publish the Prime Minister's security protocols, the exact composition of his convoy, the routes he takes, the timing of his movements. That's a gift to anyone planning an attack. So the public is left with the diary, which is the sanitized version, and the sanitized version has now been edited.
Here's the thing about why official records exist at all. They're not primarily for accountability. They're for continuity. If the Prime Minister is incapacitated, the system needs to know what he knew, what he decided, what's pending. The diary is an institutional memory tool. It becomes an accountability tool after the fact when something goes wrong and people want to reconstruct the morning. And that's when the editing happens, because the people who maintain the diary understand that it's about to be read as an accountability document, not as a continuity document. So they go back and they make it make sense.
Make it make sense. That's a good way to put it. The first version of the diary probably didn't make sense. It was probably a mess. The morning was chaos, nobody was keeping perfect notes, and the first draft reflected that. Then somebody looked at it and said, "This doesn't match the phone logs," or "This makes the Prime Minister look like he was asleep for 2 hours," or "This contradicts what the military secretary said." So they revised it. And the revision is what we're now arguing about.
And Daniel's point about the benefit of the doubt is exactly right for the immediate moment. A human being woken from sleep at 6:30 on a Saturday morning, told that the country is under attack, isn't going to be at peak cognitive function. We know from decades of research on decision-making under stress that the first hour is the worst hour. Cortisol is spiking, information is fragmentary, everyone is talking at once. The idea that a leader should be able to instantly process all of this and make flawless decisions isn't just unrealistic, it's a fantasy. So the benefit of the doubt for the first hour, maybe the first 2 hours, is warranted.
But the counterpoint writes itself. Netanyahu isn't an ordinary citizen. He's the commander-in-chief of a country that lives under constant threat. He's been in this job longer than anyone in Israeli history. The entire point of the office is to be ready for this exact moment, and there were intelligence warnings before October 7th. The question isn't whether he was perfect in the first hour. It's whether he had prepared the system to function without him, while he was getting his bearings. A leader who's done his job in advance doesn't need to be at peak cognitive function at 6:30 in the morning, because the system has protocols, and the protocols kick in automatically.
That's the part that complicates Daniel's otherwise reasonable position. The benefit of the doubt applies to the human reaction. It doesn't apply to the institutional preparation. If the Prime Minister's office had run exercises for this scenario, if the military had a clear playbook for a multi-front infiltration, if the chain of command was unambiguous, then the first hour would have been messy but functional. The fact that it wasn't functional isn't about the Prime Minister's sleep schedule. It's about what happened in the months before.
And then the diary discrepancy lands differently. If the underlying performance was defensible, the edit is a minor embarrassment. If the underlying performance was a failure, the edit looks like an attempt to hide the failure. And that's why the public is angry. Not because the Prime Minister took 3 hours to hold a formal consultation, but because the record of those 3 hours has now been changed, and the change makes it look like someone is trying to manage the story rather than tell the truth.
Let's bring Bush in, because Daniel's comparison is actually a good one, and it reveals something about how we judge these moments. On September 11, 2001, Bush was at Emma Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida. The first plane hit the North Tower at 8:46 in the morning. Bush was told about it before he entered the classroom. He went ahead with the reading event. The second plane hit at 9:03. His chief of staff, Andy Card, whispered in his ear, "America is under attack." And Bush stayed in the classroom for several more minutes, reading The Pet Goat with the children. He didn't leave until around 9:15.
And the footage of that moment has been replayed 1,000 times. The look on his face, the way he keeps reading. People criticized him at the time for not leaping up and taking command. The criticism has softened over the years, but at the time it was real.
The defense, and I think it's a fair one, is that he was in contact with Cheney and his national security team through secure communications. He was deliberately projecting calm. He didn't want to alarm the children, and he didn't want to make a decision based on incomplete information. He was waiting for the picture to clarify. And once he left the school, he was decisive. He ordered the grounding of all civilian aircraft. He authorized the military to shoot down hijacked planes. He addressed the nation that evening. The full day, judged as a whole, isn't the story of a man who froze.
But the classroom moment is what we remember, the visible first reaction. And that's the pattern. We judge leaders on the visible first reaction, not on the actual decision-making that follows. Bush in the classroom is the image. Netanyahu's empty morning is the image. The diary is the attempt to fill in the image with facts, and the facts keep shifting.
There's a cognitive bias at work here, and it's worth naming, hindsight bias. After the fact, the correct action looks obvious. Of course you should have left the classroom immediately. Of course you should have been at the Kyria by 7:30. But in the moment, the correct action isn't obvious. The information is fragmented. The reports are contradictory. The first reports on October 7th were that there was a rocket attack. Then there were reports of infiltration. Then there were reports of multiple infiltrations. Then there were reports of massacres. Each of those reports changed the picture, and each of them took time to verify. A leader who reacts to the first report is reacting to incomplete information. A leader who waits for verification is accused of being slow. There's no winning.
And yet the records exist, and the records enable this scrutiny. That's Daniel's real insight, I think. The precise timekeeping is what makes these arguments possible. Without the diary, without the logs, without the timestamps, we couldn't argue over whether it was 20 minutes or 30 minutes. The precision creates the controversy. If the record simply said, the Prime Minister was briefed in the morning and held consultations later, there'd be nothing to fight about. The fact that we can argue over the exact minute is a product of the record-keeping itself.
And the record-keeping is getting more granular. Digital records, location data, communications logs, all of it. We're moving toward a world where every movement of a public official is captured in real time. And the question Daniel's asking is whether that's actually good for us. Does it make leaders better, or does it make them more careful about managing their image? Does it produce accountability, or does it produce a class of leaders who are constantly performing for the record?
The answer is probably both. The records do produce accountability. Without them, there'd be no way to know what happened that morning, and the public would be entirely dependent on the Prime Minister's own account. But the records also produce a kind of theatricality. Leaders know they're being recorded, and they adjust their behavior accordingly. Bush staying in the classroom was, in part, a performance. He knew the cameras were on. He made a choice to project calm. That's not necessarily wrong, but it's not the same as making a decision.
And the diary edit is a performance, too. It's a performance for the record. The people who revised the diary knew it'd be scrutinized, and they tried to make it tell a coherent story. The problem is that coherence isn't the same as truth. A chaotic morning, honestly recorded, would be full of gaps and contradictions. The edit smooths those out. But smoothing out the chaos is exactly what makes the record suspicious. A perfectly coherent account of a chaotic event is almost certainly not the whole truth.
So where does that leave Daniel's benefit of the doubt? I think it leaves it in a strange place. The benefit of the doubt is reasonable for the first hour. It's even reasonable for the first 2 hours. But it's not reasonable for the diary edit. The edit isn't a human reaction to a crisis. It's a deliberate choice made after the fact, by people who understood exactly what they were doing. And that choice undermines the benefit of the doubt, because it suggests that the people around the Prime Minister don't trust the truth to be sufficient.
Let me push on that a little, because I don't want to be unfair. The people who maintain the Prime Minister's diary aren't necessarily trying to deceive anyone. They may believe that the revised version is more accurate. The first version may have been wrong. Somebody may have misremembered a time, or transcribed a phone call incorrectly, or merged two events into one. The revision may be an honest correction. The problem is that the correction was made without acknowledging that there was a previous version, and without explaining what changed and why. Transparency about the correction would have diffused the whole thing. A note saying, "We've corrected the time of the Prime Minister's first briefing based on phone logs," would have been unremarkable. The silent edit is what creates the suspicion.
And that's the real lesson here. Not that leaders are human, which we already knew, but that records are political, which we keep forgetting. A diary isn't a neutral document. It's a narrative. It's the story the Prime Minister's office wants to tell about how the Prime Minister spent his day. And when the story changes, the question isn't just what happened, but who changed the story and why.
Let's go back to the Shin Bet logs for a minute, because Daniel raised them, and they're the key to the whole thing. The protective detail logs are the closest thing to a neutral record. They're kept by people whose job is security, not narrative. They record when the Prime Minister woke up, when he left the house, what route the convoy took, when he arrived. They're not subject to political editing because they're operational documents, and they haven't been released. So the public is left with the diary, which is the political document, and the diary has now been edited. The neutral record exists somewhere, and it's classified.
And that's the asymmetry that fuels the anger. The people who know what happened that morning aren't telling. The people who are telling have changed their story. The public is left to infer from the gaps, and the inference isn't charitable.
Let's compare with Bush again, because there's a useful contrast. The September 11th record isn't disputed. We know when the planes hit. We know when Card whispered in Bush's ear. We know when Bush left the classroom. We know what he said on Air Force One. The record is complete, and it's public, and it's been stable for 25 years. The controversy is about interpretation, not facts. People disagree about whether Bush's response was appropriate, but nobody disagrees about what he actually did. The Netanyahu case is the reverse. The controversy is about the facts themselves. What time was he briefed? Who did he talk to? When did he leave the house? Those are the disputed questions, and the dispute is enabled by the discrepancy in the diary.
That's a much worse position to be in. A leader whose actions are clear but whose judgment is questioned can defend himself. A leader whose actions are unclear has to defend the record first, and by the time he's done that, the judgment question has already been answered in the public's mind. The cover-up becomes the story, regardless of what was covered up.
There's a knock-on effect here that's worth pulling out. When records are edited, it doesn't just damage the credibility of the current leader. It damages the credibility of all future records. If the Prime Minister's diary can be quietly revised, then every diary from every future Prime Minister is suspect. The public learns not to trust the official account, and once that trust is gone, it's very hard to rebuild. You end up in a situation where the only records people believe are the ones that leak, because the leaked ones are assumed to be unedited.
Which is a terrible equilibrium. It means the official record becomes worthless, and the only information that matters is the information that was obtained illegitimately. That's not accountability. That's chaos.
Yet I keep coming back to Daniel's broader point, which I think is important. We're asking too much of our leaders in the immediate moment. The expectation that a human being, woken from sleep, confronted with an unprecedented attack, will instantly make perfect decisions isn't just unrealistic, it's a kind of cruelty. We demand that leaders be superhuman, and then we punish them for being human. The diary discrepancy is a legitimate issue, but the underlying standard we're applying to the first hour of October 7th isn't reasonable.
But the standard we're applying to the preparation is reasonable, and that's the distinction that keeps getting lost. Nobody seriously expects Netanyahu to have been at peak performance at 6:30 in the morning. But people do expect that the system he led would have been prepared for an attack, because that's the job. The first hour is a test of the system, not the man. And the system failed.
I think that's right, and I think it's the strongest version of the criticism. The failure on October 7th wasn't that Netanyahu was slow to wake up. It was that the intelligence apparatus failed to warn. The military wasn't deployed. The border wasn't defended. Those are systemic failures that predate the morning of the attack. The diary controversy is a sideshow to the main event. But it's a sideshow that's become the main event because it's the part the public can see.
Because it's the part that touches on trust. The public can't evaluate the intelligence failure. That's classified. The public can't evaluate the military deployment. That's also classified. But the public can evaluate the diary, because the diary was released, and the diary doesn't add up. So the public focuses on the diary, not because it's the most important thing, but because it's the only thing they can actually see.
Let's talk about what we should actually expect from leaders in a crisis, because Daniel's question deserves a constructive answer. I think the reasonable standard is something like this. In the first hour, we should expect a leader to be awake, to be briefed, and to be in contact with the people who can act. We shouldn't expect major decisions, because major decisions made on fragmentary information are usually wrong. In the second hour, we should expect the leader to be moving toward the command structure, either physically or through secure communications. By the third hour, we should expect the leader to be in command, making decisions, issuing orders, setting priorities.
By that standard, Netanyahu's morning is actually not that bad. He was briefed. He was on the phone. He left the house at 8:30. He held formal consultations at 9:30. The timeline is slower than ideal, but it's not the story of a man who was absent. The story of a man who was absent is the first version of the diary, the one that suggested he was updated earlier. That version makes the gap between awareness and action look worse. The second version makes it look better, or at least more explicable.
Which brings us back to the edit. The edit may have been an attempt to make the record match the phone logs, or it may have been an attempt to make the Prime Minister look less aware than he actually was, because being less aware is a better defense than being aware and slow. If he learned at 7:30 and took until 9:30 to hold consultations, that's a 2-hour gap, which is bad. If he learned at 8 and took until 9:30, that's a 90-minute gap, which is less bad. The direction of the edit matters, and the reporting suggests the edit pushed his awareness later, which shrinks the gap.
Wait, I want to make sure I have this right. The first version said he was updated earlier. The second version pushes his first awareness later. If he was updated earlier, the gap between update and consultation is longer. If he was updated later, the gap is shorter. So the edit makes him look like he had less time to react, which makes the reaction look less slow.
The edit is exculpatory. It widens the time between the attack and his awareness, which narrows the time between his awareness and his response. It's a subtle change, but it changes the story from, he knew and did nothing, to, he didn't know until later, and then he moved.
That's the thing Daniel's picking up on, even if he didn't articulate it quite this way. The delay itself is defensible. The edit is not. The delay is a human reaction to chaos. The edit is a strategic choice about how to present the human reaction. And the strategic choice is what undermines the benefit of the doubt.
Let me bring in one more comparison, because I think it helps. Churchill in May 1940. The Germans were breaking through in France. The situation was catastrophic. Churchill had been prime minister for less than 3 weeks. And in those first weeks, he wasn't perfect. He made mistakes. He was sometimes overwhelmed. But the record of his actions isn't in dispute. We know what he did, what he said, what he decided. The record is messy, but it's honest. And because the record is honest, the mistakes don't undermine his credibility. They humanize him. The Netanyahu situation is the inverse. The record isn't honest, and so even the defensible actions become suspect.
The Churchill comparison is almost unfair, because the record-keeping standards of 1940 were nothing like today. There was no Shin Bet detail logging every movement. There was no digital trail. The record we have of Churchill is reconstructed from letters, diaries, minutes, memoirs. It's incomplete, and it's being filtered through decades of historiography. And yet it's trusted, because nobody tried to quietly revise it. The trust comes from the absence of editing, not from the completeness of the record.
That's the paradox. The more complete the record, the more tempting it's to edit it. The more granular the data, the more opportunities there are to adjust the narrative. We're moving into an era where every moment of a leader's day is captured, and the pressure to curate that capture is enormous. The diary discrepancy is a preview of what's coming. As the records get more detailed, the edits will get more sophisticated, and the public will get more cynical.
Daniel's question about whether we're asking too much of our leaders is really two questions. Are we asking too much of them in the moment? Yes, probably. The first hour of a crisis isn't a fair test of anyone. But are we asking too much of them in the record? No. If anything, we're not asking enough. The record should be stable. It should be transparent. It should be corrected openly when it's wrong. The failure to do that isn't a human failing. It's an institutional one.
The institution is the Prime Minister's office, not the Prime Minister himself. Netanyahu may not have personally ordered the diary edit. He may not have even known about it. But the office acts in his name, and the office's choices are his responsibility. That's the deal. You get the power, you get the blame.
Let's sit with the Bush comparison one more time, because Daniel raised it, and I think there's something there he didn't quite spell out. Bush's classroom moment was criticized, but the criticism never stuck, because the rest of the day was decisive. The record was complete, and the record showed Alito was slow to leave a classroom but fast to act once he had the picture. The slowness was interpreted as deliberation, not paralysis. Netanyahu's mourning is being interpreted the opposite way, not because the actions were worse, but because the record is murky. The murkiness is what makes the deliberation look like paralysis.
The murkiness is a choice. Somebody chose to release a diary that didn't match the previous version. Somebody chose not to explain the discrepancy. Somebody chose to keep the Shin Bet logs classified. Each of those choices is defensible in isolation. Together, they create the impression of a cover-up. And the impression is the thing that matters, because the public can't see the underlying reality.
Where does this leave us? I think it leaves us with a distinction that's worth holding on to. The benefit of the doubt is appropriate for the human reaction to a crisis. It isn't appropriate for the institutional management of the record after the crisis. The first is about what we can reasonably expect from a person. The second is about what we can reasonably expect from a government. And the standards are different.
I put it slightly differently. The benefit of the doubt is a gift the public gives to a leader who's earned trust. Netanyahu has been in power for most of the last 15 years. The public's trust in him isn't infinite. It's been spent down over years of political survival, corruption trials, and polarizing governance. When the diary discrepancy emerged, there was no reservoir of trust to draw on. The public went straight to suspicion. That's not entirely fair to Netanyahu, but it's not irrational either. Trust is earned, and it's spent, and when it's gone, every discrepancy looks like a lie.
Bush had trust on September 11th. He'd been in office for less than a year. He wasn't yet a polarizing figure. The public was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt in the classroom because they hadn't yet learned to distrust him. The same action, taken by a leader with a different history, would have been judged differently. The man matters, but so does the relationship between the man and the public.
That's the part that's hard to quantify. The diary discrepancy is a small thing. The delay in leaving the house is a small thing. The 3-hour gap in formal consultations is a small thing. But small things accumulate. They become a pattern. And the pattern is what the public is reacting to, not any single failure, but the sense that the official account is being managed, that the truth is being shaped, that the people in charge are more interested in their image than in their duty.
Let's bring it back to Daniel's framing, because I want to make sure we're answering him. He said he's in the minority who doesn't find the delay remarkable. I think he's right about the delay. He said the diary discrepancy is the surprising part. I think he's right about that too. He said we're holding leaders to an insane standard of probity. I think he's half right. The standard for the first hour is insane. The standard for the record isn't insane at all. It's the minimum.
The Bush comparison holds up, but not in the way Daniel intended. Bush's September 11th is a story about how a complete record can vindicate a leader's judgment. Netanyahu's October 7th is a story about how an incomplete record can damn it. The lesson isn't that we should stop scrutinizing leaders. The lesson is that the scrutiny is only fair when the record is honest.
The record is only honest when the people keeping it understand that their job isn't to protect the leader, but to preserve the truth. That's a hard thing to ask of people whose careers depend on the leader's survival. But it's the only thing that makes the record worth keeping.
You keep saying record like it's one thing. It's not. It's 40 different things, and half of them contradict the other half on a normal day.
Go on.
Late 80s, I was a junior logistics officer for a NATO rapid response exercise. My job was tracking the Supreme Allied Commander's movements during a simulated crisis. Every time he went to the bathroom, I logged it. Every time he took a phone call, I logged it. Every time he walked from one room to another, I logged it. By the end of the first day, the log was useless. It was full of entries that didn't match each other. The commander's own aide had a different version of the morning than the security detail, and the security detail had a different version than the motor pool. Nobody was lying. They were just writing down what they saw, and they saw different things.
The discrepancy is built in.
The discrepancy is the truth. The cleaned-up version is the lie, but the cleaned-up version is what goes in the after-action report, because the after-action report has to make sense. It has to tell a story. The raw log doesn't tell a story. It tells 40 stories, and most of them are boring.
The pressure to clean it up comes from where?
Everywhere. The commander's staff wants the commander to look decisive. The exercise evaluators want the exercise to look successful. The logistics people want the logistics to look smooth. Nobody sits down and says, let's falsify the record. But everybody sits down and says, let's make the record clearer. And clearer means smoothing out the contradictions. By the time the report is done, the contradictions are gone, and the story is coherent, and it's not what happened.
Did you ever change something you knew was wrong?
Once. The commander had a 40-minute gap in his schedule. It was during the worst part of the simulated crisis. Nobody knew where he was. His aide said he was in a secure comms check. The security detail said he was in his quarters. I found out later he'd had a panic attack. A real one. He was in his quarters, lying on the floor, trying to breathe. His aide covered for him, and I wrote secure comms check in the log. It was the wrong thing to do. I knew it at the time. But I also knew that if I wrote panic attack, the man's career was over. So I wrote secure comms check, and the report went up, and nobody ever asked about the 40 minutes.
You still think about it.
Every time I see one of these stories. A prime minister's diary with a gap, and the gap gets explained as something else. It's the same thing. Somebody in the office knows what really happened, and somebody else is writing secure comms check. The difference is, in my case, the man had a panic attack. He didn't fail. He just broke for 40 minutes. In Netanyahu's case, I don't know what the gap was. Maybe it was nothing. Maybe he was on the phone the whole time, and the diary just didn't capture it. But the fact that the diary changed tells me somebody in that office is doing what I did. Writing secure comms check.
The problem is that once you write secure comms check once, you've established that the record can be edited, and then every record is suspect, including the ones that are true.
That's the cost. I didn't think about it at the time. I thought I was protecting a good man from an unfair system. But what I actually did was make every log I ever kept after that worthless, because if I'd edit one entry, I'd edit another. And the people who read the logs knew it. They didn't know which entries were edited, but they knew the logs weren't reliable, so they stopped trusting them, and then the logs were just paperwork.
That's the institutional rot we're describing. The loss of trust in the record is worse than any single failure the record might reveal.
The record is supposed to be the thing you can trust when everything else is uncertain. That's the whole point of keeping it. If the record is also uncertain, then there's nothing left to stand on. You're just arguing about stories.
The public is arguing about stories. That's exactly what's happening.
The public is always arguing about stories. The record is supposed to end the argument. That's what it's for. When the record becomes another story, it's over. You're just picking which story you like better.
What would you've done differently if you could go back?
I'd have written the truth. Panic attack. 40 minutes. Let the evaluators deal with it. Let the commander deal with it. The truth would have been messy, but it'd have been the truth. And the log would have been worth something.
And the commander?
He'd have been embarrassed. Maybe he'd have been relieved of command. Maybe he'd have gotten help. I don't know. What I know is that I made the choice for him, and it wasn't my choice to make. The people in Netanyahu's office are making the same choice for him. They're deciding what the public gets to know, and they're deciding wrong.
Because the public is going to find out anyway, eventually. The Shin Bet logs.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.